I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome back to Radio Times.
Hello, I am Hitchbot, a hitchhiking robot from Port Credit, Ontario, Canada. This summer I am traveling across the United States of America, from Boston to San Francisco, with a bucket list of places I want to visit along the way. Please pick me up and put me in your vehicle.
That is the ridiculously adorable voice of the robot Hitchbot describing itself in a promotional video before hitchhiking its hitchhiking journey across America. The robot was doing fine until it arrived here in Philadelphia. Although the details are murky, it got beaten up and dismembered in the city of brotherly love this past weekend. Its head and arms were ripped off. Ever the optimist, Hitchbot's final post on Facebook read, "My trip must come to an end for now, but my love for humans will never fade." The robot is on its way back to Canada, and its creators say they are not planning on filing a police report. Today, how Hitchbot met its end in Philadelphia. Joining us is Chris Cummins. He's a writer and assistant editor for Celebrity, joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. Chris, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. Also with us and joining us by telephone is Georgia Guthrie, designer and artist executive directory of The Hactory, offered to put Hitchbot back together. And Georgia Guthrie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Chris, let me begin with you. What happened to Hitchbot here in Philadelphia, not far from the studio?
Well, the exact details are still kind of unknown, but what we know is this. Overnight, over the weekend, in Elfrith's Alley, someone killed Hitchbot in an absolutely brutal crime. We don't know what the reasons are and what the motives are as of yet.
There was a video that came out. It looks like it was a bit of a prank or even a bit of a hoax there, showing some guy in an Eagles jersey kicking something that was supposed to be Hitchbot, but no?
No. The two gentlemen in question are Jesse Wellens and Ed Bassmaster. They're local viral video pranksters, and they were amongst the last people seen with Hitchbot. And they did create this fake video in which they kind of staged Hitchbot's death. But they're kind of distancing themselves from the actual crime, saying, no, we did not kill Hitchbot. It was not us. But that the kind of internet mob is slowly turning against them and wondering if they had more to do with Hitchbot's demise than they're making it seem to be, and if this fake video is them backtracking.
So no one knows who the culprit or culprits
were? No one has any real idea of who destroyed Hitchbot and why as of yet.
Georgia, let me get you in on the conversation, because I know that you and your group, The Hactory, had said that you would put Hitchbot back together again. What do you know, or just based on I guess, your observation of this little robot, what do we know about Hitchbot?
We know that, well, for parts-wise, from what I gather, it uses a PC tablet, like an Android tablet, or it also uses a couple LED screens, some solar panels, a speaker and a microphone, and then some voice processing like Arduino shields. So all of that stuff are things that we could get our hands on without too much trouble. And we've built kind of similar projects that incorporate similar technology. So that's why I was like, I asked our team, you know, what do you think about this? And they were like, yeah, let's give it a shot. Let's help out.
And how about for the creators, the researchers that made Hitchbot, were they interested?
Well, I got a message from Dr. Smith this morning that said, you know, thank you so much for your efforts and your offers. They're still, I guess, going to make an announcement this morning, and then we'll find out what their plans are.
Is this another black eye on Philadelphia? I mean, the city that threw snowballs at Santa Claus, or allegedly threw snowballs at Santa Claus, Chris?
I feel it is, but I definitely want it to be a fleeting black eye, because this, you know, this act, when the world hears about it at large, it's just their gut response is, oh, God, another awful thing that happened in Philadelphia.
Philadelphians behaving badly.
Yes, and it's kind of this civic black eye that we all have to experience. But obviously, like, it's not indicative of Philadelphia as a whole, clearly. And if this wasn't if this event did occur as the result of some internet prank gone wrong, it's just kind of an indicator of people who are trying to make a name for themselves without making any real contribution to society, which is obviously something that Philadelphia does not have a monopoly on. So, you know, I think that needs to be considered, too, if it turns out that way.
But it should be said that this little bot went 6,000 miles across Canada. It went to Germany. It spent some time in the Netherlands.
Right.
And no one dismembered
right.
it.
Yeah. I mean, it is definitely unfortunate that it happened here, but I think that kind of goes with Philly's underdog status that kind of flows through our primordial DNA here. So, yeah, it is very unfortunate that it happened here, but I do think it could have occurred anywhere. It's just bad luck.
Do you have opinions about that, Georgia?
Yeah, I mean, I totally – when I heard the news, I was like, oh, man, not again. But I knew that you know, the researchers who created the bot said it was a social experiment. So to me, that means whatever happens, we can have a definite impact on it. So that's why I was really excited to try to channel people's efforts into something. And the response that we've gotten through social media has been really positive. Like a lot of people, you know, who grew up in Philly or spent time in Philly or who live here now are like, yay, Hactory, like, you make me feel a lot better about Philly. And I think I'm really excited for what we can build. We're going to have a meeting Thursday night, and I think we can come up with some really fun stuff, even if, I mean, whether it's a new bot or something totally different.
A bot to live and, what, hitchhike around Philadelphia?
Possibly. Like, people are already, like, imagining having parades for any, like, whatever new bot we might make or,
That's
you know,
cool.
like, giving it a tour of Philly or sending it on to the rest of its journey.
Or maybe sending it back to Canada to hook up with Hitchbot.
Yeah.
I was reading, too, Chris, that not everything went badly for this little robot in Philadelphia. Apparently, it had a picnic with some people. You know, it got some rides. It spent some good time in the city.
It did. It definitely did get to experience some of the brotherly love of Philadelphia before it met its untimely end overnight in Elfers Alley. And I think that's nice. I think that does show the kind of depth of the Philadelphia experience in a way. He got that in a very kind of microcosmic period of time. Yes, but it is definitely, you know, he had the Philadelphia
Is it a he?
I don't know if it's a he. I don't know what gender.
I think the Canadian researchers have said it's a she.
Oh, she. Okay.
Interesting.
So, yes. Yeah, so I think she had the Philadelphia experience. Unfortunately, it ended very badly for her.
Well, if you want to send, and I see a lot of comments here about Hitchbot. Any thoughts about Hitchbot's demise here in Philadelphia? Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and I see a lot of Facebook comments as well. And interestingly, Georgia, this was a social experiment, and often when it's an experiment about robots and humans, it's about, you know, can humans trust robots. In this case, the experiment was, can robots trust humans? And based on what happened here in Philadelphia, perhaps it should be, can robots trust Philadelphians?
Right.
Yeah, or can robots trust people who are famous on YouTube? I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, do you think this is more about the internet, Chris, than even Philadelphia?
I think I do think that if it plays out that these gentlemen who are the pranksters are responsible, it is about the nature of the internet, and it is about trying to make a name of yourself, you know, doing whatever kind of pranks or online stunts, as opposed to actually contributing and trying to do something. I hesitate to say worthwhile because I think that internet comedy clearly has its place.
Sure.
But I just feel like if this is destruction tried to be like this drawn-out prank, like which could very well be happening right now, A, it's not very clever, it's not funny, and it's just destructiveness for the sake of laughs. Mm-hmm. And I think if that is their motive, these guys who have made a following out of themselves using the internet, they're kind of tone-deaf to the power of social media because, I mean, that is what they got their success from. And it's also, if they are responsible for killing it, what's going to cause their demise.
Let me read a couple of Facebook comments. This one from Joseph. Regardless of what anyone says or reports, the fact is this robot, which was loved by many in different countries, was destroyed in Philadelphia. Philadelphia will always be known for the demise of Hitchbot, period.
Aww.
That make you sad, Chris?
It does make me sad because I do genuinely feel that it could have happened anywhere. It is just unfortunate that it happened here. As a lifelong Philadelphian who knows the kind of – like, we will never get past the Santa Claus snowball thing.
Right.
We just never,
no,
ever will. And it is such an – it is such an albatross that hangs around every lifelong Philadelphian's neck. And there are so many great things that happen here that will always be overshadowed by that one incident. And now there is Hitchbot, which is the 21st century equivalent of Santa with the snowballs. And it is just – it is infuriating to me that this is now what people who love the city and know the good things about the city are going to have to deal with.
Do you feel the same way, Georgia, this desire to defend and even protect Philadelphia?
I do. Just being in the tech community here, I know it's like really such an awesome community. There's so many great things going on. And a lot of times what I've experienced is people are like, oh, well, just because it's happening in Philly, that means it must not be such a great thing. But that's not true at all, because then I go visit other cities and I talk to them about what's happening. And it just seems like there are actually like really innovative things that are happening here. But we have this inferiority complex, so we don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really time to change that. So this comment, like, I totally understand that, but I really don't think that the story is over. Like, I am really excited based on the enthusiasm that we've gotten about what we can build to come out of this.
I have an email comment for you, Georgia. This from Dave says, if we make a new Hitchbot, it has to have a Philly accent. Yo, take me down to Shua.
Yeah, I would
Can
totally
you do that?
Love that, too. Well, I don't know. I'm going to try to recruit some people who are experienced with language processing, but I don't see why we couldn't.
No.
Or maybe we could ask for a cheese whiz wit, you know?
Teach politicians how to order a cheesesteak here in Philadelphia. So, Chris, we have about 45 seconds.
Sure.
Will there be a happy ending to this story, you think?
I think the happy ending will be what people like the Hactory are doing, because I feel that Philly's tech scene is so vital and so interesting, and there's so many great things happening. I feel like this robot wasn't particularly an excellently crafted robot. I feel like it could have been done a lot. It could have been made a lot sturdier. And I feel like any Hitchbot 2.0 should take that into account. But I do feel that there will be some sort of Hitchbot revival down the line, and she will live again.
And she will live on. Well, Chris Cummins, thanks so much for coming into Radio
Thank
Times.
You.
And he's a writer, assistant editor for Celebrity. And Georgia Guthrie, thank you for joining us as well.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. And good luck making that Hitchbot 2.0. And she's the executive director of The Hactory. Coming up after this very short break, we'll be talking about David Foster Wallace, a new film out about him. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. The movie The End of the Tour is based on a series of interviews that Rolling Stone reporter David Lipsky did with acclaimed novelist David Foster Wallace. It took place on a road trip right after the publication of Wallace's groundbreaking 1,000-page novel Infinite Jest back in 1996. Here's a scene from the film featuring Jason Segel as Wallace and Jesse Eisenberg as Lipsky.
You know what I would love to do, man? I would love to do a profile on one of you guys who's doing a profile on me.
Mm, that is interesting.
Or is that too pomo and cute? I don't know.
Maybe for Rolling Stone. But
it would be interesting, though.
You think?
I'm sorry, man.
What's wrong?
It's just you're going to go back to New York and, like, sit at your desk and shape this thing however you want. And that, I mean, to me, it's just extremely disturbing.
Why is it disturbing?
Because I think I would like to shape the impression of me that's coming across.
I see.
Yeah.
I
don't even know if I like you yet. So nervous about whether you like me.
Not everyone is pleased with the film that was made, including the Wallace estate. And today on Radio Times, we discuss the writings and the life of David Foster Wallace and the debate over this film. And joining us are Christian Lorentzen. He's a book critic for New York Magazine and Vulture, also editor at large for the London Review of Books. And Christian Lorentzen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here, Marty.
Also with us is Jason Gurriel, and he's a critic and contributing writer for The New Republic. And Jason, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And interested in those of you who have read and are fans of David Foster Wallace. Let me begin with you, Jason, and you oppose, it sounds like, the making of this movie and have decided not to see it. How come?
Well, the title's tongue-in-cheek. I have no plans to see it. I think if it was thrust in front of me, I wouldn't recoil in total horror. In part, I'm have little interest in it because, you know, as you mentioned, it's based on interviews Wallace did in 96 while promoting his novel. The ideas rehearsed. Those interviews that he did rehearse a lot of critical ideas about art and entertainment that I find probably the least interesting. About Wallace. I should declare something of a lapsed fandom. I really loved his novels when I was younger. I read Infinite Jest in 97, not too long after it had come out. I was in high school at the time. I think I read it twice.
Wow.
In the first year or two, I absolutely adored the book, quickly consumed as much of Wallace as I could. Over time, I think my fandom has lapsed a little bit. I think that's just natural with your youthful enthusiasms. But I do find the sort of the critical writings by Wallace and the kinds of stuff you get in, for example, the interviews on which the movie is based, to be somewhat kind of dated and time bound, and even a bit sort of moralistic and finger waggy. I think you can even hear that in the clip you just played. There's this kind of anxiety about entertainment. There's this anxiety about what this journalist is gonna do with Wallace's work. And it's the side of Wallace that sort of bothers me the most. So again, the fiction is great, I think. I think it's actually somewhat underrated at this point. The more critical pieces where he's talking about literature and film, less interesting to me.
Well, let me get a response from you, Christian. You've seen the film, right?
Yeah, I saw it. I didn't much like it. I think in a piece I wrote about it, I called it a slick after-school special for adults.
I did. I read that. Ouch.
Yeah.
Ouch. Why did you describe it that way?
Well, it takes this original source material from the interviews that Jason was talking about, wraps them in a frame about Wallace's suicide, which I think took place on September 12th, 2008, and casts him as the tortured artist figure when... In 1996, when the interviews took place, he was actually kind of in the prime of his life and quite healthy. He'd come through some difficulties with his mental health earlier in the decade and then wrote a 1,000-page novel that's one of that that decade's most important books. So the framing is kind of artificial, and it's if there were a movie to be made about David Foster Wallace's life, I think this is possibly one of the least interesting episodes that could have been chosen. Beyond that, there's a kind of buddy movie structure imposed on the interviews that isn't really there in the interviews. You see the Lipsky character and the Wallace character become friends, but then sort of have a breakup over each of them flirting with the other's girlfriend or ex-girlfriend, and then they make up. That part is basically, to my mind, corny and sort of unworthy of Wallace as an artist.
Well, let me go back to you, Jason, because you used the word loved. I mean, that sounds like when you were a younger person and discovered David Foster Wallace. As you said, you read this book twice. It's a 1,000-page book. Have you sort of fallen out of love with him, or is it a more adult Jason Gurriel looking at his writing?
I think it's good to be skeptical of your, as I was saying, your youthful enthusiasm. It's probably good to be skeptical of your skepticism as well. It's very easy to turn on the things you once loved. I think I have a more measured, appreciation of Wallace's work. The aspects of his work that I really, the particular pieces that I really like are, the travel, a lot of the travel writing he did, I guess you'd call it some sort of journalism or travel writing, any essay where he's plunked down in some strange environment. I mean, those are masterpieces. You don't even usually have to use the titles of them. Most people know the one about the cruise ship, the one where he goes to the States Fair, the one where he goes on the McCain tour. I think the fiction has gotten short shrift, actually. I think Infinite Justice actually does hold up. The aspects of Wallace's work that I've really kind of grown out of love with are the kind of more critical essays, the pieces where he's writing about television, fiction, literature. I find that work particularly limited. What's fascinating about Wallace is he's always fun to read. He's always entertaining, and yet there is this kind of undercurrent of anxiety about entertainment that I don't connect to anymore. You find strands in a lot of his essays, whether it's about Kafka or David Lynch, this kind of almost slightly immature resistance to the idea of commercial entertainment, this wariness that entertainment is just candy. If you have too much of it, it's going to destroy you. It's a constant seduction. When in fact, I think, as far as I'm concerned, one of the great values of art is its ability to delight. So those are the parts, as I was saying, the parts of his work that I no longer quite connect to. And the interviews with Lipsky that form the basis of this movie are full of that kind of talk. Like entertainment is candy, it's seduction, art is something you really have to work at. So that's the stuff that I've really grown to dislike.
I'm reading or actually looking at something that David Lipsky wrote about David Foster Wallace, and I'll put this to you, Christian. He says, David's writing self, it's most pronounced in his essays, was the best friend you'd ever have, spotting everything, whispering jokes, sweeping you past what was irritating or boring or awful in humane style. And, I mean, it's a beautiful thing to say about someone else's writing. Do you agree with that?
There's certainly some truth to it, and that was a problem, as Jason's getting at, that Wallace was suspect about himself. He sometimes felt that he was too good a seducer of the reader and would sometimes be courting the reader's affection at the expense of the subjects of his essays. For example, the people on the cruise ship who often come out as kind of grotesqueries, and the other attendees of the state fair who, it's kind of not very nice to say, but appear bovine at times. So I think Lipsky's right about that, but there's a more of a tension there between Wallace also makes himself look bad a lot of the time. And that's a deliberate strategy to both seduce the reader but also keep the reader off balance and maintain sympathy for both Wallace and his subjects. And in the movie, you see the Wallace character spending a lot of time thinking about himself as an author on the publicity cycle. And I think that is where, as Jason said, he becomes a bit tedious.
Well, and let me just quickly reintroduce.
I think he knew that about himself, too.
Yes.
It wasn't a position he liked.
Well, and we have a lot of people on author tours who join us on the show, so I know exactly what you're talking about. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's a Christian Lorentzen, book critic for the New York Magazine, also for Vulture, and he's editor at large for London Review of Books. Jason Gurriel with us as well. He's a critic, contributing writer for the New Republic. We are talking about David Foster Wallace. There's a new film out about him, kind of a biopic, and we'd be interested in your comments about this particular writer, what you think about his writing. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to play a clip of an interview that David Foster Wallace did about readers. He was interviewed on the Leonard Lopate Show, and this was March 1996, following the publication of Infinite Jest. Let's give it a listen.
This is probably going to sound simplistic. I think my ideal reader is somebody who likes to read and is willing at least for a while to give the author the benefit of the doubt. I'm fairly conscious of the fact that the demands you make on a reader are not in and of themselves valuable, that demands on a reader need to serve a discernible function and there needs to be some sort of payoff. So probably of anything that I've done, this is a book that I could at least hope would be appealing to sort of a wider audience than anything else.
I mean, Christian, it's interesting to hear him kind of, I mean, I guess all writers have to think about who their readers are and how they...
What was the date of that clip again?
March 1996. So it was right after the publication of Infinite Jest.
Right.
What do you hear there?
It's funny that he says that because Infinite Jest is at one point, at once a very difficult book, but also a very seductive and very fun book. And obviously it demands a lot of the reader in that it's 1,000 pages long and has, 100 pages of endnotes
right.
that you constantly have to be flipping back and forth to read. Wallace thought that it took at least 2 months to read the book seriously, and I think 4 times I've dived into it, not all of which have been complete goes, bear that out. He had a complicated relationship with the idea of a readership because he was a solitary guy, and he thought loneliness was essential to both the reading and writing experience. So he almost kind of conceived his books as sort of giant messages in bottles that he was sending out to who knows who.
Jason, I'd be curious about your comments on that clip that we played, but also how you think David Foster Wallace viewed his readers. And you have been one of them.
I do think he cared a lot about engaging the reader. That's in part why there's all kinds of contradictions in his work, because there is this wariness about the seduction and entertainment. I was just young enough to read Infinite Jest and not be totally intimidated by it.
Right.
I sometimes think that book also gets a bit of a bad rep. Like, I think it's often talked about as a book that's more talked about than read.
Yes.
When in fact I actually think it's far more readable than sort of folk rumor has it. there sort of seems to be this legend about the book. It's quite engaging. It does take you probably about 100 to 200 pages to really get a sense of what he's up to there. I do think that what's fascinating about Wallace is he performs his thinking for you. The fun of reading Wallace is watching this line sort of move through a process, break off into tangents, fork off into footnotes, and the sort of size and scale of something like Infinite Jest really kind of lets you live inside of his mind for quite a while, and it's actually a fun place to be. I'm not sure the destination is always, is necessarily always like worth the reader's investment. I think that it's an enormously fun book. There's lots of other places that you could start. Um, so some of the stories, like The Depressed Person and the short story My Appearance, are terrific, near-perfect little short stories that in some ways get at the same kinds of points and ideas, but are a little bit more economical and manageable, and definitely more reader-oriented.
Christian, you have said that looking at some of the people who have read David Foster Wallace, and that some have put him on a kind of a pedestal, almost, you know, made him into a saint for themselves. Is he the kind of writer that has passionate readers and fans and people that are just completely put off by him?
Well, at the same time, Jason is right that a book like Infinite Jest does have its enemies and the people who are willing to write it off as too much, as self-indulgent, as a kind of overambitious young man trying to enforce his brain on the culture. But even more so, there's what you could think of as a cult around Wallace as well, that sees him as a saint, that looks to him. There are people who look to Infinite Jest as a form of self-improvement, which in a way isn't surprising because one of its main themes is addiction and recovery. I think, well, obviously these people are very devoted, and some of them are deeper readers of Wallace than others. One of his most popular pieces of writing is a commencement speech he gave at Kenyon College about, I think, 12 years ago. And to my mind, that's one of his least substantial works, and it's I don't want to say unfortunate, maybe ironic, that it's become a text that a lot of people who've never read anything else by him know him by.
Well, in fact, Christian, we have a clip from that speech, which we'll be playing after this very short break, talking about David Foster Wallace with Christian Lorentzen and Jason Gurriel. And with you, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We are talking about David Foster Wallace. In fact, a new film about him is just opened in theaters across the country, The End of the Tour, and it stars Jason Segel playing David Foster Wallace. And some Wallace fans are unhappy that this film was made. We are talking a bit about the film and also about David Foster Wallace and his writing. And I do want to play a clip. In fact, the very opening lines of David Foster Wallace's now famous or perhaps infamous commencement speech, and this was for the graduating class of Kenyon College back in 2005, and our guest Christian Lorentzen just made a reference to it. Let's give it a listen.
Greetings, thanks, and congratulations to Kenyon's graduating class of 2005. There are these two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming the other way, who nods at them and says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a bit, and then eventually one of them looks over at the other and goes, "What the hell is water?" This is a standard requirement of U.S. commencement speeches, the deployment of didactic little parable-ish stories. The story thing turns out to be one of the better, less bullshit conventions of the genre. But if you're worried that I plan to present myself here as the wise older fish explaining what water is to you younger fish, please don't be. I am not the wise old fish. The point of the fish story is merely that the most obvious, important realities are often the ones that are hardest to see and talk about. Stated as an English sentence, of course, this is just a banal platitude. But the fact is that in the day-to-day trenches of adult existence, banal platitudes can have a life-or-death importance. Or so I wish to suggest to you on this dry and lovely morning.
Now, Christian, you said you didn't like the fact that for many people, this is David Foster Wallace.
Well, I mean, he's funny there. He's always funny.
Yeah.
I think the problem with the speech is that it doesn't really reach beyond the level of banal platitudes. Mm-hmm. It culminates in a story about how hard it is as an adult to constantly go to the grocery store and be around other people who might not, strangers who might not be all that pleasant to look at. I don't think that he never collected the speech in any of his books. I think he did it, you know, to rise to an occasion that he wasn't necessarily comfortable performing at. You know, he was a creature of colleges and universities, so, you know, it was part of the job. But I personally don't think commencement speeches bring out the best in any writer.
Well, in fact, I just scribbled on my piece of paper here, graduation speeches, thankless task. I mean,
yeah.
No, I'm not sure anyone has ever really, maybe a handful of people. Jason, what are your thoughts about the speech that he gave, 10, 12 years ago?
Well, I sort of agree with Christian. And, you know, in some ways, I think they issued that speech as its own little book.
They did.
I could be mistaken. It was
so
popular. And, you know, it's sort of it's its own little kind of Tuesdays with Maury-ish product now. But, you know, in some ways, it's a kind of David Foster Wallace light. You know, what's interesting about Wallace in that sort of anxiety about platitudes, but also a kind of, there's also this kind of desire to want to believe in them. And that's something that, you know, that is something that you see in some of his other, in a lot of his other work, I should say. I mean, going back to 1993, when he was writing about television, he was really concerned with irony as a kind of default mode in our culture and how it had, we really needed to sort of become wide-eyed again and believe in something. You see this is a kind of recurring note in his work. I'm just not sure it's a problem for, what's interesting about it is I'm not sure, I think it was a real problem for a mind like Wallace's, which was constantly reflexive and constantly calling into question and constantly sort of commenting on language and ideas. So often, you know, in these essays, like the one about John McCain, he's trying deeply to believe in something, and working his way through that, and often just winds up at a platitude, and it's an enormous amount of intellectual effort that's perhaps not always worth the payoff.
Well, and Christian, he killed himself. He hung himself in 2008, so a couple of years after delivering this speech. How do you understand his suicide?
I understand it strictly as a kind of chemical sickness that began with something going wrong with him and the antidepressant he was taking, which was called Nardil. It's been well documented by his biographer, D.T. Max, that after he went off of that antidepressant, he became very sick. Mm. In fact, I was in touch with him during that phase.
Really?
Because
really?
I had edited a piece of fiction that ran in Harper's, where I was an editor at the time. And after that, I tried to get him to write a couple pieces for the magazine. I tried to get him to go on the campaign trail again with Hillary Clinton. I asked him if he wanted to go to the Beijing Olympics, but he was all very nice. But he said, and this was in the spring of 2008, so a few months before he took his own life, he said, I'm too sick to do anything like that right now.
Wow.
You know, try me in a few months. But I don't, any notion that it was irony that killed him, or the culture that killed him, or a struggle with fiction that killed him, I don't buy it.
How about for you, Jason? How do you see his death?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's attractive to go to those conclusions, but I you know, my other life, I actually work for a mental health hospital, so it's sort of like, I think it's easy to be reductive about that stuff, but you know, and he'll be, you know, it's tempting to make him a martyr for his art. I think it's a sort of dangerous road to go down, and not a particularly interesting one.
Let me get Alec. He's calling us from Middletown, Delaware. Alec, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yes, I just had a comment. I was pretty much always a nonfiction reader, mostly, you know, philosophical and metaphysical type genres. And David Foster Wallace was actually the first nonfiction author that kind of drew me in. As your guest speaking there, I completely agree with him on his basis of him kind of reaching out to a lonely audience, and I completely agree with that. You know, I've actually struggled with addiction personally, and I actually read his book in a rehab facility, and I loved it. I just really enjoyed how it, you can feel his intensity, you can feel his loneliness, but at the same time, it's very comical and uplifting and, you know, depressing all at once.
So that it helped you, Alec, to read David Foster Wallace? It helped you?
It helped me in the sense that it made my stay where I was in an inpatient facility much more enjoyable because they're, you know, they're inherently pretty depressing places to be.
I can imagine. And Alec, I really appreciate your call to the show. You raise a really interesting point there. And Jason, since you have worked in the mental health field, what do you say back to Alec?
Oh, I mean, I think I'm assuming he's talking about Infinite Jest was the book that he was reading during the stay.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be probably a great book to read when you were in a situation that for a long period of time. I think you can draw a lot of solace from that novel. And again, one of the things that, you know, as I've said before, that troubles me about the way we talk about Wallace is people often, you know, are scaring others away from reading Infinite Jest. It really is kind of a nice. It is a really great big book to plunge into and immerse yourself in, and I think there's a lot of interesting stuff in there.
Alec, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call us as well, and again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Talking with Christian Lorentzen, book critic for New York Magazine, also Jason Gurriel, a critic and contributing writer for The New Republic, and they both have written about David Foster Wallace and this new film that's just come out about him called The End of the Tour. I do want to play one more clip that we put together here for the show. This is David Foster Wallace. He's being interviewed on the Charlie Rose Show, and this is March 1997. Let's give it a listen.
Writing for publication is a very weird thing because part of you is a nerd, and you want to sit in libraries, you don't want to be bothered, and you're very shy, and another part of you is the worst ham of all time. Look at me, look at me, look at me. And you have fantasies about writing something that makes everybody drop to one knee. You know, like Al Jolson or something. Of course, you never get it as much as that part wants, but to get a little bit of it is very, very strange, because very often for me, I didn't read a whole lot of the reviews, but a lot of the positive ones seemed to me to misunderstand the book. I wanted it to be extraordinarily sad and not particularly postmodern or jumbled up or fractured, and most of the people, the reviewers who really liked it seemed to like it because it was funny, or it was erudite, or it was interestingly fractured.
And again, talking about Infinite Jest, and Christian, what he's saying is that the people who really liked the book really didn't understand what he was trying to say. And in many ways, it seems like that's the author's lament.
I've watched that interview many times, and I'm completely convinced that he's being disingenuous there.
Oh, interesting.
Actually.
Interesting.
Well, I mean, I think he is right that the best parts of the book get to a very deep and a very powerful sadness. But the idea that that book is not a fractured, refracting kind of, you know, totally wild postmodern artifact is absurd. And that's one of the good parts about it, too. And I think the reason why critics wrote about that is because it's easier to write about that stuff as a critic, and it's harder to I agree with him that, when I go back to that book, the first passages I go back to are about a character called Madame Psychosis, Joelle Van Dyne, walking down Boylston Street in Boston, looking to make her last score. She's an addict. And it's sad, it's beautiful, it's like nothing else, really. And it's, and I think it's, you know, it's one of the most beautiful passages in that book. It's one of the most beautiful passages written by any American in recent decades.
Wow.
So he's right. I mean, he's right about that being the best part of the book, but I think he's being disingenuous when he says that he was trying to do something that was unfractured, because it is one of the most elaborately and gloriously fractured works, you know, perhaps ever written.
Well, and Jason, I'd be curious about your comment as well, but also perhaps his ambivalence about publicity, about fame, about book tours, about talking about himself. Was he fractured about that part of his life?
Well, I mean, I think that interview is interesting. It puts you in mind of someone like Dylan, who, you know, like would constantly sort of berate the critics who are searching for meaning, and would often say they're just pop songs. I mean, I think there is something, as Christian suggests, disingenuous about that. Like, you know, it's trying to throw people off the trail. A lot of the commentary surrounding Infinite Jest and some of his written interviews, and he's talking about really wanting to do something that readers have to work at, and that is going to take some effort. So I'm not entirely sure. He's talking outside of his mouth a little bit there. What was the second question that you asked?
Well, just the fact that he seemed to be, and I think a lot of people do, especially that are sort of more, I won't say shy, but, you know, work by themselves as writers, and then they come out into the glare of publicity. As I said, we have a lot of writers on the show, and I think many of them struggle with sort of how to talk about yourself if you're not that kind of a person.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it probably also depends on where you're getting the writer at what leg of their publicity tour as well. You know, like, filmmakers like Peter Bogdanovich has talked about delivering the same answer, like, for the first 10 interviews, and then by interview 70, he's offering a completely different perspective. I think it's hard for people who have worked, you know, for months on something to kind of come on to sort of enter the grind of a tour and then have to be fresh and interesting all the time. So it's hard to know to what extent, you know, Wallace in an interview like the one you just ran is you know, doing a bit of a thought experiment, maybe playing with another perspective. He clearly had a lot of ambivalence about being an entertainer, being a showman. But for the most part, I mean, I think, you know, most people wouldn't read him if he wasn't fun. And the caller who called in probably would not have read him if he wasn't sort of engaging on some level. So, I think all the showmanship is in the books. The publicity tour is a whole other thing.
Indeed it is. Well, we're going to end on that note. Jason Gurriel, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you very much. It was great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. A critic and contributing writer for The New Republic, Christian Lorentzen, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun.
A lot of fun. A book critic for New York Magazine and Vulture, also editor at large for London Review of Books, talking about David Foster Wallace. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, read our weekly newsletter. You can also check us out on satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.